Because in contrast, the motto of my undergraduate school, Scripps College, is Incipit Vita Nova. Here begins the new life. Fitting and accurate for a bunch of young adults, the vast majority who are still teenagers, living away from home for the first time. But for CST, their motto is meant to be a charge. A charge for people who are not teenagers and who already have an idea of what they want to do in the world. Their main goal is to train religious leaders who can respond ethically and morally to the social crises of the times they live in. Because there are always moral, ethical, and social crises to respond to no matter the decade or century you live in. And often, those challenges will be the same ones previous generations struggled with and perhaps failed to deal with. 2024, 56 years after Dr. King's assassination, seems like an important time to think about the moral and social crises of his day, which we are still referring to, or still, you know, responding to over half a century later, and how his faith and lessons are still for such a time as this. My New Testament professor, noted expert on the origins of Christianity, Gregory Riley, told my class that Christianity was, at the core, the charge to pick up your cross and follow. He would often say that's all we have to do. Just pick up your cross and follow. As if it were the easiest thing in the world. And I would be like, wait a minute, that's not easy at all. Because, for example, when we talk about someone's cross to bear, like, oh, his brother is his cross to bear, we mean their heavy burden or duty. Nothing about that phrase implies easy. Easy and duty rarely go together. The things that we have to do, the things that we are called to do, are almost never easy. But we have to do them as if they are. Once you know what you have to do, when your duty is clear, you can just get on with it. But maybe you can sing a song about it first. Random fact about me, which will probably come as no surprise, but I love musicals. One of my favorite musicals is called Aida. Not the opera, but the Elton John Tim Rice show. One of the songs in the musical, a true bring down the house belter, is a song about this concept. It's called Easy as Life. Our protagonist, Aida, the princess of Nubia, who is currently enslaved in Egypt, is coming to terms with the fact that she's going to have to break her own heart, you know, and make the hardest decision she's ever had to make, and choose duty over love because, and then I see the faces of a worn, defeated people. A father and a nation who won't let a coward run. Is this how the gods reward the faithful through the ages? Forcing us to prove that the hardest things we've done are easy. So easy. And though I'll think about him until the earth draws in around me, and though I choose to leave him for another kind of love, this is no denial, no betrayal, but redemption. Redeemed in my own eyes and in a pantheon above, it's easy. It's easy. It's easy as life. Just pick up your cross and follow. That was Riley's point. Numerous teachings in the Bible speak about the way being both really easy and also the hardest thing ever. In Micah 6:8, it says, He has shown you, O mortal, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. That's it. But in Matthew 10, Jesus says, Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross daily and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. but whoever loses their life for me will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world and yet lose or forfeit their very self? In Stride Toward Freedom, The Montgomery Story, Dr. King speaks about being on the steps of the Montgomery Courthouse, newly convicted of unlawful boycotting the city buses, but yet being anything but somber or upset. His crime, quote, "It was above all the crime of seeking to convince my people that non-cooperation with evil is just as much as a moral duty as is cooperation with good." Dr. King and his followers had already taken up their crosses and were following. Of the rude awakening to the powers that be that jail, fines, and convictions were not going to deter the movement, Dr. King says, "The members of the opposition had also revealed that they did not know the Negroes with whom they were dealing. They thought they were dealing with a group that could be cajoled or forced to do whatever the white man wanted them to do. They were not aware they were dealing with Negroes who had been freed from fear. And so every move they made proved to be a mistake. It could not be otherwise, because their methods were geared to the old Negro, and they were dealing with a new Negro. These new Negroes had already endured and survived slavery, Reconstruction, and now Jim Crow. After centuries of brutality and disenfranchisement, being arrested and sitting in a jail cell was a bit of a walk in the park. And it wasn't unexpected. When Jesus sends out the 12 disciples into the world, he warned them that they were not going to have a good time at all. In fact, they were going to have a terrible time. On the one hand, they were going to be given the power to heal, like Jesus, so yay. But on the other hand, they were going to be driven out of towns, arrested, and probably killed. "I am sending you out like sheep among wolves. Therefore, be as shrewd as snakes and as innocent as doves. Be on your guard. You will be handed over to the local councils and be flogged in the synagogues. On my account, you will be brought before governors and kings as witnesses to them and to the Gentiles. But when they arrest you, do not worry about what they will say, or excuse me, about what to say or how to say it. At that time, you will be given what to say. For it will not be you speaking, but the spirit of your father speaking through you. Brother will betray brother to death, and a father his child. Children will rebel against their parents and have them put to death. You will be hated by everyone because of me. But the one who stands firm to the end will be saved. When you are persecuted in one place, flee to another. Truly, I tell you, you will not finish going through the towns of Jerusalem before the Son of Man comes. So do not be afraid of them, for there is nothing concealed that will be not be disclosed, or hidden that will not be made known. What I tell you in the dark, speak in the daylight. What is whispered in your ear, proclaim from the roofs. Do not be afraid of those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. Rather, be afraid of the one who can destroy both body and soul in hell. Are not two sparrows sold for a penny? Yet not one of them will fall to the ground outside your father's care. And even the very hairs of your head are all numbered. So don't be afraid. You are worth more than many sparrows. The way is hard, and the immediate reward is often persecution and death. But there is, according to Dr. King and Jesus, a huge benefit to suffering for a righteous cause. King says, "What is the nonviolent resistor's justification for this ordeal to which he invites men? For this mass political application of the ancient doctrine of turning the other cheek? The answer is found in the realization that unearned suffering is redemptive. Suffering, the nonviolent resistor realizes, has tremendous educational and transforming possibilities. King isn't just referring to internal education and transformation. If he was, the appeal of this method would be a lot more limited. That's not necessarily the kind of self-care or self-help I'm looking for. I'd much rather use a bath bomb instead of being literally bombed, especially if it's just for the sake of allegedly being a better person. I don't need growth that badly. And I don't think I'm alone in that sentiment. So no, the transformation King was talking about was internal and external. Suffering for practical reasons and concrete gains. Suffering and nonviolent resistance as a political strategy with goals and achievable aims. King's commitment to nonviolence is often either misunderstood as passive, ineffectual, and naive, or, you know, used in not good faith to criticize other forms of resistance. But King's theory of nonviolence was rooted in deep intellectual understanding and knowledge of philosophy, history, sociology, psychology, and world religions. In his writings, he regularly name-drops people like Nietzsche, Kierkegaard, Hegel, Marx, Du Bois, Kuhn, and many other serious thinkers and scholars you definitely recognize. There's serious praxis here. In many of his writings and speeches, he clarifies that when he speaks of things like love, he's not being sentimental. This isn't a soft love. Quote, "We should be happy that he, Jesus, did not say, like your enemies. It is almost impossible to like some people. Like is a sentimental and affectionate word. How can we be affectionate towards a person whose avowed aim is to crush our very being and place innumerable stumbling blocks in our path? How can we like a person who is threatening our children and bombing our homes? That is impossible. But Jesus recognized that love is greater than like." I'm doing this so I don't sneeze. "When Jesus bids us to love our enemies, he is speaking of neither eros, romantic love, or philia, like family love. He is speaking of agape, understanding and creative redemptive goodwill for all men. Only by following this way and responding with this type of love are we able to be children of our Father who is in heaven." But this isn't just about being children of God or good Christians or good citizens of the world. This is also about practicality. King notes in many places that violence and retaliation has not worked anywhere at any point in history. We keep trying it because part of it's instinctual. Someone hits you, you hit them back. But, quote, "The aftermath of nonviolence is the beloved community, so that when the battle is over, it's over. And a new love and a new understanding and a new relationship comes into being between the oppressed and the oppressor." What we're seeing in the world today are so many tit-for-tat, generational, fear-thy-neighbor type of blood feuds that have no end in sight because no one is changing their minds, no one is being won over, and no one is ashamed of their actions and thus committing to a new way. It's just passing down hate, resentment, and trauma to new people. Like when a Broadway show goes on tour and the actors change, but the show stays the same. And that's great when you're a Broadway fan and now you don't have to go to New York to see Hamilton. But it's terrible if you're a villager in the Balkans caught in the middle of a deadly 900-year conflict that absolutely no one living knows the beginnings of or why you're even fighting at that point. It takes courage to break cycles of violence and commit to not letting your intrusive thoughts win, especially if you have power and many people are invested in the status quo being maintained. Quote, "It must be emphasized that nonviolent resistance is not a method for cowards. It does resist. If one uses this method because he is afraid or merely because he lacks the instruments of violence, he is not truly nonviolent. The method is passive physically, but strongly active spiritually. It is not passive non-resistance to evil. It is non-violent resistance to evil." And I think that bears repeating. So the method is passive physically, but strongly active spiritually. It is not passive non-resistance to evil. It is non-violent resistance to evil. That was the first point of nonviolent resistance. A second tenet of nonviolence resistance is that the aim is not to defeat or humiliate the opponent, but to, quote, win their friendship and awaken moral shame within them. Humiliation leads to bitterness, which can lead to a desire for revenge. I often wonder what would have happened in Germany. I often wonder what would have happened if Germany was treated differently after World War I. Would there have been a World War II? We'll never know, of course. But it's notable that after World War II, the Allies took a decidedly different approach with Germany compared to after World War I. And one of the third characteristics of nonviolent resistance is that you attack the system rather than individual persons within the system. Again, this is the hard way. It's harder to be angry at a faceless system that seems undefeatable instead of the person in the cubicle next to you who is subjecting you to microaggressions and their bad breath. And another point of nonviolence is, quote, "Concerning nonviolent resistance is that it avoids not only external physical violence, but also internal violence of spirit. The nonviolent resistor not only refuses to shoot his opponent, but he also refuses to hate him. At the center of nonviolence stands the principle of love." Again, this is not the easy way. This is not a soft love. This is not for cowards. This is hard work. The sixth point of nonviolent resistance is based on the conviction that the universe is on the side of justice. Consequently, the believer in nonviolence has deep faith in the future. The faith is another reason why the nonviolent resistor can accept suffering without retaliation, for he knows that in his struggle for justice, he has cosmic companionship, a creative force in this universe that works to bring the disconnected aspects of reality into a harmonious whole. Recall the famous King quote that we probably all know about the arc of the moral universe being long but bending towards justice. And finally, I think the main reason King advocated for nonviolent resistance is because he was afraid that if humanity didn't learn how to resolve our issues without violence, we would literally destroy ourselves with weapons of mass destruction. Our survival as a species is on the line, and that's more true today than it was in the 1960s. Our protection during the Cold War was supposedly that, no one was crazy enough to push the button first. But we now know just how close we came to someone pushing the button. And even without nuclear weapons, we have plenty of other weapons of mass destruction that can level and have leveled cities and kill thousands of people at a time. Our planet is covered with millions of people who have been maimed and displaced by war and armed conflicts. Huge numbers, millions of refugees. Generations that have never known peace. This world needs brave warriors for peace who are willing to put it all on the line for our future. So I'm going to leave you with these final words of wisdom from Dr. King. They're from his 1967 writing, not long before he was assassinated. Where do we go from here? Chaos or community? Quote, one of the great liabilities of history is that all too many people fail to remain awake through great periods of social change. Every society has its protectors of the status quo and its fraternities of the indifferent, who are notorious for sleeping through revolutions. But today, our very survival depends on our ability to stay awake, to adjust to new ideas, to remain vigilant, and to face the challenge of change. The large house in which we live demands that we transform this worldwide neighborhood into a worldwide brotherhood. Together, we must learn to live as brothers, or together we will be forced to perish as fools. So in summation, stay woke, y'all. Don't sleep through the revolution. It is our moral and ethical duty to speak out against injustice. The time is always right to do what is right. It is a time such as this to finally create the beloved community. Go outside these doors and be a resistor, a courageous warrior for love, the person Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. believed you could be. The world and our future depends on it. So amen, and may it be so.
Recording stopped.
Thank you, Nyala. That was a wonderful talk, and I look forward to listening to it again on the recording that we captured today. Our closing hymn, which Sydney is bringing up, is the famous We Shall Overcome. And I remember singing this when I was helping protest the Vietnam War. Fort Collins, Colorado, Foothills UU Church.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday. Oh, deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome someday. You walk hand in hand. Someday. shall all be free. We shall all be free someday.
Sydney, now is the time to blow out our candles and chalices at home and here in Huber Chapel as I read these words by Jonalu Johnstone. We shall overcome. When we can truly celebrate the diversity of contributions and talents offered by all people, we shall overcome hatred and prejudice and oppression. When we can truly extend our hands to one another in loving acceptance, we shall overcome the past that haunts us now. Living in peace and freedom, we shall overcome the wrongs that have happened and the debts left unpaid. Let us join together in that commitment to overcome. Amen. And now we'll have a few brief announcements before our coffee break and our joys and sorrows. We do not have a discussion.
So thank you for the offering, and thank you for everyone who participated today, making the service possible. We will now take a moment to share our joys and sorrows. We take this time to acknowledge any gratitudes or concerns we may carry in our hearts. If you wish to acknowledge any of these, I invite you to come forward and drop a stone or several into the bowl on the altar. Okay, I don't know what you're saying. What's happening?
We're trying to make a breakout room for our people, but I don't know if that's happening.
Well, I joined the room, but I don't think other people got the... There was no big announcement there that didn't break out room.
Anyway, nothing would just automatically be pulled in if that's not my understanding.
Here, I'll try to tell people by doing this.
Okay, I'm going to continue what I was saying. I invite you to come forward and drop a stone or several into the bowl on the altar. You may also use the microphone to briefly share your joy or sorrow aloud. As the water ripples, our prayers move out from this spiritual community into the world. And so we begin.
actually have a few joys to announce. First, about 8 months or so, my daughter entered a contest. She lives in Scotland, so the contest was Undiscovered Voices of Children's Literature in the UK. And got notice about 3 months ago that she was winner of the contest. And it was a big secret. We couldn't reveal it. Yesterday they went to an event in London for that. And then next month they're going to be, she and her husband are going to be going to a get-together with agents and children's literature publishers. They published an anthology with her work and a few more people's works, which got published yesterday, which was very nice. So that's announcement one. Announcement two is they are coming to visit us for the next 4 weeks, arriving this evening. So we're glad to welcome them. And then the third one is we enjoyed going to my son's event yesterday at Lockheed Martin Skunk Works for the rollout of the X-59 plane, which is my son's program of public affairs officer for that. So it's all good news. Thank you.
Anything on Zoom?
No, I said in the chair of chat, I didn't see anybody type anything. You could ask them if they want to mute themselves or share something. Bob's unmuted, but you didn't say anything.
I wish I could see the screen. Is there anyone on Zoom who would like to unmute and share? Thank you, Beth. I saw a no. Okay, we hold all that has been shared today. We know that some things emerge slowly.